This episode is brought to you by Fuli Gemstones.
She was mad about the panther because she was annoyed by the success of the panther. She wrote once that everybody wants the panther, the panther, the panther. While we have beautiful birds, we have snakes, we have crocodiles, we have lizards, we have turtles, we have beautiful creatures, and all what the women want is the panther, the panther, the panther.
I'm Carol Halton, the voice of jewellery. Welcome to If Jewels Could Talk. I'm an author and broadcaster, and the woman who initiated the role of jewellery editor at magazines like Tatler and Vogue. This is a podcast for everyone, for people who do like jewellery, for people who don't realise they like jewellery, and anyone intrigued by fascinating facts, new ideas, and forgotten histories. So join me as I tell sparkly tales and meet all sorts of people, delving into four centuries of jewellery culture, and investigate what's happening now. I'm in Paris this morning. We are here to talk about the great 20th century designer Jean Toussaint of Cartier. She was a Belgian-born French jeweler and designer who exerted considerable influence on jewelry design after Louis Cartier appointed her the director of fine jewelry in 1933. She was renowned for having impeccable taste, and she's remembered particularly for panther designs. And today we're going to find out more about her legacy at Cartier. And I'm delighted that I'm in the Jean Toussaint room with Pierre Ranereau, the style, image and heritage director of Cartier. Thank you for hosting me this morning, Pierre.
Thank you, Carol. You're very welcome.
And Pierre, I just wanted to talk quickly about her early life and what you know about her early life. In my research, I couldn't see much in her early life that would suggest that she was going to go on to have this incredible role in the jewellery world.
You know, she was born in 1887 in Charleroi in Belgium, from very modest origins. And in fact, what we know is that she arrived in France when she was still a teenager. And apparently, she fled a very difficult family situation where her mother remarried, and the situation and the atmosphere, let's say, in the family was not very serene at the time. And she joined her sister, who was already living in Paris.
How old was she then?
She was probably in her 16, 17 years old when she got here. And at the time, a girl of that age could be, let's say, working in a real life. She was not in the situation that we know today for teenagers. You know, she could be independent. And independence at the time for a young girl like her would go through the help of men. And that's how, very quickly, she, let's say, had a protectors.
Was that the old word, demi-mondaine?
Demi-mondaine.
And which wasn't a derogatory term or a derogatory way of life at the time.
It was a situation that many, again, young and beautiful ladies would know because of, let's say, the difficulty of life of that
time. They had to survive.
They had to survive. But, you know, very quickly, she had that nickname, La Panthère.
So who gave her that?
We don't know, but probably it's her status in terms of demi-mondaine that is linked to that nickname of La Panthère. And it's very interesting.
So one of her early lovers would have called her that.
And because, you know, she was part of a crowd of young, beautiful ladies who were present at Maxime's or, you know, at many trendy restaurants and cafes at the time. And La Panthère had a meaning at the time for her. It meant that she was independent and she could choose her protector or protectors. And she was ferocious in that way. You know, and it's already very, very interesting because among all her, let's say, competitors, she was known for her strong personality and independence. You know, she met with Louis Cartier, we think around 1914. She had a previous lover, Baron Pierre de Quinsonnas, who was very famous in the aristocratic life. And Pierre de Quinsonnas was really a strong love for her. He wanted to marry her, and the family didn't want too, because of course of her status in the society of the time.
I think that's very similar to Chanel, isn't it? Because these women, however strong and independent and however creatively brilliant, the loves of their lives didn't marry them because they were seen to be not quite good enough to marry.
Reputation was essential at the time. When you see the the articles and the papers and things, you can see that the reputation was a key point. You know, you had suicides because of reputations. You had duels. And many important things were happening because of your reputation. And the status of the family could be ruined because of reputation. So that was very, very, very important in the life of the families of a time. Mm.
So she met Louis Cartier around 1914. We don't know how particularly, but probably at Maxime's or one of these parties. And he was taken by her immediately.
Yes, he was one of the most looked after divorcees of Paris at the time. When you see the pictures of him, you can see that he was a very handsome man. He was at the time in his 30s. Cartier was already enjoying an enormous success. He was at the head of the most important jewelry house of the time. He had also a reputation of someone interested in arts and in creations in general. So he had different aspects, not only the wealth, but also a position of a person, a man of broaden interest in life. So I think Jeanne was probably sensitive also to that aspect and the personality of Louis Cartier.
And will you talk a bit about her style at the time that probably attracted him? Because she was different, wasn't she?
She was not, full of jewelry or taking advantage of her position, trying to grab as much money as possible. No, she was always dressed in a very, very elegant way. And not looking for, today we would say the bling aspect of things.
But different in the way she wore silk pajamas and turbans. And
yeah.
So a different look.
You know, she was also, there's another aspect linked to her elegance. She was also acting as a model for many, many grand couturiers of the time. And how do I know that? Because I had the chance to have very interesting discussions with Hubert de Givenchy, who knew her very well in the beginning of the 50s. It's a very interesting anecdote he told me. He, at one point, he was a very modest client at Cartier, as he told me. He was a client for watches. And he was, dealing with his traditional salesperson. And at one point, this person says, "Oh, Monsieur de Givenchy, Jeanne Toussaint wants to meet you and talk to you." Oh, he was very impressed because in the creative world of Paris, already in the 50s, Jeanne Toussaint was a myth. I said, "Okay, I'm very, very interested in meeting her." And she comes. And immediately, she said, "Oh, Monsieur de Givenchy, I know you're a friend of Mr. Balenciaga. I want to meet Mr. Balenciaga." And he said, of course, he was not shocked. He was a bit surprised, but not shocked. He smiled at her and he said, "Okay." And she invited both of them, Balenciaga and Givenchy, at lunch at her place, or at the address was number 1 Place Diana in the 16th arrondissement. And Hubert de Givenchy could remember every detail of that lunch, even the menu and everything, even the pieces of furniture in each of the rooms of the apartment and everything. And because they were in fashion, she had kept at that time, 40 years later, all her dresses from the beginning, you know, of a century. And they spent the entire afternoon till 8 at night with her as a model for all the dresses she had kept from that period, with all the big names of couture, you know, and Hubert de Givenchy and Balenciaga were all, you know, impressed by her taste in keeping, you know, the best of the best of the dresses of the beginning of a century, especially dresses not only for the shape of them, but for the exquisite work in terms of craftsmanship and métier d'art of those dresses. And some elements, by the way, are kept in the permanent collection at the Met, like some of those dresses. So just to say that Hubert de Givenchy told me, you know, Jeanne Toussaint was not à la mode. She was elegant. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference. She could pick, you know, everything that was exceptional in what was produced by the maison and of haute couture, but projecting her own vision, her own style. You were referring to her pajamas and things. That was something very important to her. She was used to wear Chinese silk fabric on her pajamas with always a little handkerchief, you know, getting out of a sleeve, you know, and using it from time to time, by the way. And she always kept the same haircut, mm-hmm. you know, from the late 1910s, you know, the short haircut like that. Sometimes totally wet, and sometimes, you know, during the day more, you know, fluffy. And so she kept her look, you know, from, you know, the 1910s till her death in the mid-70s.
So maybe that's her link, that the idea of her appreciating the work of the métier d'art, because weren't her family lace makers?
Yes, they were involved in, effectively, in the making of exquisite fabrics. And in fact, they were more, I think, dealers, not linked to the makers, but of course, probably they knew about the quality of those fabrics.
So she would have absorbed that.
Yes.
The other thing I thought that was interesting, linking her with Chanel, is that apparently she always wore pearls. So do you think, actually, Jeanne Toussaint could have been the one who influenced Coco Chanel about pearls?
This is difficult to say, because when you think about pearls at the beginning of a century, you know that they were the, let's say, the epitome of success.
It was prestige.
Because pearls, let's remember that before the First World War, they were more expensive than diamonds. So it was really a status. And at the time, there were, culture pearls didn't exist. So there was no doubt about the real value of those pearls. And on top of that, I think pearls are, when you think of that, a modest item, because they are not as shiny, brilliant as stones. They are very, very simple material, you know, when it's that preciousness attached to something organic, of course, because it grows mineral and organic at the same time, and that it grows like a miracle of nature, you know. But the result in terms of pure shape is so obvious, so, you know, so simple and so strong in a way. But pearls have an incredible richness in terms of nuances, in terms of softness, in terms of, you want to touch pearls, you know, all the time. And by the way, it's good for the pearls to be touched, as you know. There's a kind of sensuality in pearls on top of that status that was attached to them.
So they both would have been attracted for that reason.
Definitely. Yes. And it goes with everything. Mm-hmm. And you can wear also at night and during the day. Mm-hmm. So that's exceptional in a way.
So she's met Louis Cartier. They obviously start a relationship. Then how quickly did he want the relationship to turn also into a professional one?
It took years, because in fact, it's only at the end of the First World War that he wanted to marry her. And again, the same story is repeated, I think, with at the time of Baron de Quinsonas. And the Cartier family refuses that absolutely. And what was at stake at the time was not only the reputation of the Cartier family, it was also the reputation of a business of Cartier. Because, you know, the clientele of Cartier at the time had an enormous prestige. You know, Cartier was the first supplier to royal courts, you know, the number of official warrants, you know, obtained from royal courts was, you know, the most important one ever for a house of jewelry. So what was really in danger in the eyes of the members of the Cartier family was the success of a business of a Cartier house. So that's also why probably Louis Cartier accepted, because with the strength he had, he could have refused, you know, the will
of his father,
and also of his brothers. And in fact, he accepted it in the name of a good for the House of Cartier.
So after the war, he gave her a role designing handbags.
Yes.
Because of her ability to work with different fabrics.
First of all, I will make a comment on the word design, because she was not a designer. She never designed herself. But we keep in our archives some of her sketches for bags, and also some of her, let's say, constructions. You know, with paper, she could define a silhouette of a bag, you know, and build something with her hands like this, and then give it to, you know, the supplier or to another person, a designer, to really put in shape what she had in mind. But we have some examples of that. But she was not a proper designer.
So she was really hard for her eye.
Yes, exactly. And it was very, very modern at the time. She had an eye, and she had also probably a vision. And I think
a vision for women as well.
For women, and you're totally right.
And what was, I've read about Department S, which sounds like a secret society or an MI5 type of thing. I mean, what was Department S?
S was not Jeanne Toussaint's idea, by the way. It was Louis Cartier's idea. And because, you know, it was an idea that came at Cartier in 1924. 1924 is an extraordinary period for Cartier. It's a very successful period where, in terms of jewelry, we would say today high jewelry, meaning the highest and the most exclusive part of our work, was enjoying an incredible success. And came to the mind of the Cartiers at the time that could be a danger for the future. Because if you rely only on the top of the top of the offer, you could be fragile, you know, in your business. So Louis Cartier particularly had the idea that we should have a more affordable offer at Cartier that could allow more people to come to our stores. And of course, what he had in mind is something very Cartier. In the way they describe and in the documents what they wanted to offer, they say in French, any object should be à la Cartier, meaning with a Cartier touch, a Cartier vision in terms of design, beauty, exquisite material, but not necessarily requiring so many hours of work and so many precious materials. So he had the idea of S line, and in my mind, today, because, you know, many people think S for silver, because silver is probably cheaper than gold, or S for soirée, because they are elegant objects to wear during soirée, you know, in the evening. But in fact, in my mind, what comes to my mind is S for smart, because smart objects in their conception, meaning many objects were conceived with, for instance, already made fabric for evening bags, for instance. Not so many precious stones to accompany the existing materials. The objects were made of hard stones, existing sculpted hard stones put together with ornaments of coral or turquoise, you know, gold, but minimum presence of gold, you know. So you had cigarette holders, you had wear ashtrays, you wear vases to ornate your chimney piece, or you had evening bags, as I was mentioning. And in fact, it's in 1925 that Louis Cartier decided to give that department under the responsibility of Jeanne Toussaint, probably because of her extraordinary taste in that kind of development and in that kind of objects. And she succeeded beautifully in developing that that line of objects.
And was she the first woman to run a department? Because I guess men were managing the sales, the workshops, the design.
You're touching a very interesting subject, being a woman within a house of jewelry in Paris at the time, and also being a woman not belonging to the family. That was incredible, I think, to have at Cartier and in a jewelry house a woman in charge of such an important department, both, I mean, you know, the leather bags or the bags in general, plus the S department, being part also of the creative committee for all the rest of a production, of all the rest of a creation. This starting in the early 20s. So not only she had her own department, but at the side of Louis Cartier, she was going through all the projects, all the designs for jewelry, watches, clocks, and everything. So this is also very important as a position. She had to face all the men who were the designers, and it created many, let's say, conflicts, you know, because all those men, seeing a lady having a word on their work, you know, was an issue for them. Because of their generation, because of a tradition of the jewelry houses and all that. So she had to integrate that context and to probably adopt a behavior to show her strength, you know. And it was said at Cartier that she could use very strong words, you know, very bad words, to really occupy the space, you know, and to express herself the same way men were expressing themselves, you know what I mean? And and she...
So these men were swearing around the Cartier offices.
And there's a long story of conflicts, and I think...
But
I
also, she had to swallow the snub of the family. So how did she feel coming up against members of the family when they had said, you're not good enough to come into our family?
I think the brothers were very clever. And when Louis Cartier decided to retire at the beginning of the 1930s, in 1933 exactly, they fully accepted the choice of Louis Cartier to name, to appoint Jeanne Toussaint as his successor. Definitely. We have a letter in our archives from Louis written to his son-in-law, René Révillon, and he explains why he chooses Jeanne. He says she is capable, meaning that at Cartier, you know, the responsibility you have is because you are capable to have it. Whatever your origin is, whatever the horizons you come from, you know. And I think Jeanne Toussaint is the example of a philosophy of and the vision of the Cartier family. Their main objective at that stage is to, let's say, to fulfill and to project a Cartier culture into the future.
Nonetheless, it must have been hard on her emotions at some point.
But we have testimonies very quickly of the esteem of the two other brothers, both Pierre and Jacques, towards Jeanne Toussaint. And, you know, in 1955, she wants to quit. She wants to leave the Cartier house, because that's the time when she finally marry her lover after Louis, Baron Elie Doissel, who was at the head of the Saint-Gobain company. And she becomes a baroness, we would say. And she is 68 years old, sorry, at the time. And she thinks, you know, she wants to enjoy life. And we have an incredible letter from Pierre Cartier, who is retired himself in Geneva, to her, to ask her to stay. And how he has, at the same time, he feels, of course, affection towards her after all those years, but also esteem. And, and then, at the time, he has the same words as Louis Cartier had, you know, almost 25 years before. So it shows how the family now considers her as part, you know, of a, and not only part, but a pillar of a Cartier culture, which is really at the origin of what Cartier does.
And sort of going back a bit, talking about the ruffling of the men's feathers within the business, I mean, she did come to blows a bit with Charles Jacquot, didn't she? Now, Charles Jacquot was, I mean, showing how extraordinary Louis Cartier was in the people he brought into the company, Charles Jacquot was never a jewellery designer. He met him up a ladder when he was creating a balcony.
He was a designer in cast iron. So, and you know, when you look at Parisian architecture, you will see how cast iron is very, very important everywhere since the 17th century, and especially in the period of Haussmann. You know, all those buildings were done in the mid 19th century till I think the beginning of the 20th century. And cast iron was very, very important at the time. And he was effectively a designer for that. And there are many similarities, by the way, between the so-called Garland style of the beginning of the century and the design in terms of cast iron. So Charles Jacquot was hired in 1909, I think 10 years after Louis Cartier started, you know, within the house.
Because he just admired what he was doing, some trellis
work. Yes, he was very talented. He has an incredible hand in what he was doing. And the inspiration of Charles Jacquot is incredible, and his capacity to let's say integrate all the different shapes around him. You know, of course, Charles Jacquot is not at the origin of Louis Cartier's vision, because, for instance, the interest of Louis Cartier into Islamic art was before Charles Jacquot. But again, Louis Cartier has Jeanne Toussaint, was not a designer. He couldn't, you know, draw
but
anything.
Charles Jacquot could translate Louis' vision
definitely
in drawing and
but,
design.
But I would say that not only he understood what Louis Cartier had in mind, he shared the immense curiosity towards many aspects of the art world of the time. But he was also what Louis Cartier would have called an inventor. You know, Louis Cartier used to call the designers the inventors. So it says a lot of two different things. That first, Louis Cartier and Jeanne Toussaint are in charge of having the Cartier eye. That's one thing. But they recognize entirely the origins of the ideas. And the origins of the ideas come from the designers. They could be, you know, guided. They could be nurtured by many, many ideas or books, images of examples coming from all over the world, culture, nature, and so many different things. But at the end, they are the ones who put the idea on the paper, you know, and they are the inventors. Today, we internally call them the creators, but it's another way to recognize the initiative in terms of ideas. And both Louis Cartier and Jeanne Toussaint did recognize the where the ideas were coming from.
So Jeanne Toussaint and Charles Jacquot, they probably were both very competitive over their relationship with Louis Cartier?
I think they were. I think they were, because I think in 1933, after all those years, Charles Jacquot thought he would be the successor of Louis Cartier. And for him, probably it was an enormous disappointment when Jeanne Toussaint, I mean, was appointed as artistic director for the entire jewelry house. And then was born, you know, the antagonism between the two. Probably already before 1933, during the creative committee, having Jeanne Toussaint at the same level as Louis Cartier in front of Charles Jacquot was already an issue, I think, for him in terms of ego. And when Jeanne Toussaint arrived 10 years, you know, after him in the house, he probably looked at her as, you know, as a superficial addition to the way of working within Cartier in that field of the creative department. So yes, it was an issue, and especially also because then progressively Jeanne Toussaint headed to other directions that the once Charles Jacquot followed till her arrival. So I think everything was rather smooth till the death of Louis Cartier. And after the death of Louis Cartier in 1942, then really that was an issue, and Charles Jacquot progressively was isolated into the department after the Second World War, especially.
I read, I don't know if this is true, in 1945, that he came across Jeanne Toussaint being photographed for a Harper's Bazaar shoot, and she was poised with a pencil that was going over one of his designs, and he was obviously very, very upset.
Referring to a very important picture that was taken by François Collard. It's only after the Second World War that Jeanne Toussaint was known, you know, as really an important actor within the Cartier house. And so she got some articles, some journalists were interested, you know, in knowing her, writing about her. And there was effectively a reportage, as we say in France, made within the premises of Cartier, specifically in Jeanne Toussaint's office. And the photographer and the journalist asked her to work on design. In fact, in those pictures, she's not designing. She's writing on, because that's what she used to do, you know. And they used to comment the drawings, you know, and that's what she was doing. But effectively, there's an ambiguity. Someone who doesn't know could see that she's designing. She was not, and she didn't pretend she was designing. But the drawings under her hand were the drawings by Charles Jacquot. But she was working on a regular basis with those drawings under her hand.
But he happened to come across it and was extremely upset.
But those photos were published anyway, yes. So he could have found them in the in the magazines. So probably he misunderstood what was going on, you know, also at the time. Because she never pretended that she was a designer.
Yeah,
never.
Yeah.
So, but that shows also the state of mind of Charles Jacquot at that time.
Yes,
exactly. And, that's what happens in, you know, in corporations in general, you know, rivalry and things like that.
Yes. Now, I wanted to talk a bit about her role during the war, because these are such important years, aren't they, in Paris at that time with the German occupation. And I wanted to know Cartier's attitude at the time and how Jeanne Toussaint fitted into that.
So, as you know, in 1940, when the Germans were getting into France, all the family fled to the southwest of France, to Biarritz, and in the case of Saint-Jean-de-Luz. And Jeanne Toussaint herself had a house in Cibourg. Cibourg is very near to Saint-Jean-de-Luz. And also, they took all the stock of jewelry out of Paris to the southwest and then to an unknown destination to protect the stock. And the Cartier organized the move for all the staff of Cartier. They booked the seats in the trains, they organized everything. By the way, there's an anecdote, because Charles Jacquot arrived very late at the station and didn't want to move, and they were waiting for Charles Jacquot to move to the southwest at the time. And you imagine the rush
stress,
the panic,
yes,
the stress, and it was incredible at the time. So they were all there.
So what happened to the store here?
The store was closed.
Close.
Everything was closed. Mm-hmm. And once the Germans were in power in Paris, some decisions were taken. And in fact, a very important one was taken. If the commercial premises were not reopening, whatever the activity was, it was confiscated. So the risk was enormous. So we have letters, exchanges between the different actors of the Place Vendôme and Rue de la Paix, writing to each other, saying, what do we do? And then they decided to reopen, because what was at stake was the end of a business. So they decided to reopen with the remaining poor things that were in the store, just to say that the store was open. And Jeanne Toussaint came back. Louis Cartier went through Spain, Portugal, and moved to New York to join his brother. And he took a boat from Lisbon to New York in 1940. And Jeanne Toussaint came back to Paris and reopened the store. And the director of Cartier in the Rue de la Paix was Monsieur Deveau. So she was part of the direction, because she had a very important responsibility. together with Monsieur Deveau, who was the director during all those years.
And some of the Cartier staff were taken and interned by the Nazis.
So the ateliers were reduced considerably because all of them, or the majority of them, were prisoners of war in Germany. So, you know, and Cartier put in place a help for the wives, you know, were still in Paris to help them and the kids.
So they could just come in and take away Cartier's staff whenever they felt?
No, because those men became soldiers at the beginning of the war.
Oh, I see.
And they were kept as prisoners in Germany.
Right.
So that's what was...
So who was in the store at that time then?
Just a few people. The activity was very, very reduced. Then came other decisions.
The Germans had to be clients then.
Some of the Germans were clients. And you know that there was an artificial exchange rate between the Reichsmark and the franc. So the Germans had an enormous power to buy, you know, many, many, many different things at the time. But we can see in our archives that very often the prices asked for the Germans were much higher than the prices asked for the French.
Cartier revenge.
And that was, and also other decisions were taken because it was forbidden to buy precious materials. So the clients should come with their own precious materials to be transformed. Mm-hmm. So of course the activity was very, very reduced.
Did they help any of their clients with Jewish heritage? Were they instrumental in helping
yes.
them?
In fact, what was happening is many of our clients were not only Jewish, but many, many families, gave to Cartier their jewelry to be kept in our safe during the war to avoid, you know, the confiscation of their wealth. And in fact, after the war, of course, those families came back and we were able to give back the jewelry that was kept in our safe.
So it was quite a brave move of Jeanne Toussaint to come back. She could have stayed in
of
France.
Yeah, yeah. Her life was in Paris, and she had the idea that she had to do it. She had to do it. You know, but she had to do it. And there were the team also, you know, Mr. Deveau, the remaining workers, they felt that they had a mission.
So there's the famous story of the bird in the cage. Was Jeanne Toussaint involved in that decision?
Jeanne Toussaint was definitely, I think, at the origin of that decision. What happened is, at a certain moment, in each of the windows of 13 Rue de la Paix, you could have a presentation of what was... possible to sell at the time, but in each window you have one piece of jewelry repeating itself from one window to the other. That was a small brooch in depicting a bird within a cage, and the bird has the three colors of a French flag. So it was quite obvious. The symbol was not invented by Cartier. The symbol of a bird in a cage to express the idea that the French were prisoners of the Germans was existing before. So that's even more daring, in fact, to conceive such a brooch and to put it systematically in all the windows. Of course, it was visible to everybody, but even more so by the officers of the Wehrmacht, where the guest, in a way, of the Ritz, for instance. And the Ritz, you know, the Ritz Hotel is very near. So, of course, this was discovered and Jeanne Toussaint was arrested. Because of that. She stayed, apparently, because we don't have exactly the records of the Germans, but it was very well known internally by the people. She was a prisoner of the Germans for 3 days, and nobody knows exactly why she was freed after that. And we know that from her at the time, but explanations to the Germans that brooch was already developed in the late 30s. We had one made for Yvonne Printemps already. Yvonne Printemps was a famous actress married to a very famous also French writer, Sacha Guitry. And that was not, you know, a novelty of a time. She tried to lie, in fact, to the Germans in an acceptable way. And she was released. Some people say that it was through the help of Coco Chanel, who effectively had some links with some German authorities. Nobody knows. Nobody knows exactly. And what we know is that then, after that, Jeanne Toussaint had to prove the entire period till the Liberation Day that she was not Jewish. She was constantly in an effort to prove that she was a Catholic. We found in our archives all the letters she wrote to Belgium, or also to Lorraine, you know, because her family was has origin in Lorraine, from the cemeteries, from the town halls of all those cities, to prove that she was not Jewish. So it shows that the German authorities always had that pressure on her the entire period of the occupation days. And we know also that in 1955, she will get the Legion of Honor, and greatly because of her behavior during the occupation days.
And then the bird was depicted as free and liberated at the end of the war.
Exactly, in 1944. And you see the same bird within the cage, but with the open doors, and the bird at the, you know, at the door, singing, you know, just to state, you know, the freedom.
I found a quote from Cecil Beaton, which I thought was really lovely about her, and it sort of, you know, like the bird singing, it was almost like she was enacting the sense of freedom. He said he recalled the night shortly after the liberation in Paris. She rode to meet him on a bicycle in drenching rain, and he said, with her long, many ropes of pearls festooning the handlebars. And you just get that sense of joy, don't you?
Definitely.
And so I want to scroll back a bit now to the first design of the panther. That was 1914.
Yes.
And that was by Charles Jacquot.
Yes.
But we associate the panther now with Jeanne Toussaint.
The design of 1914 is not a panther. It's the fur of a panther.
The fur of a panther. To make that.
And let's be precise. And let's not forget that since 1909, 1910, and effectively it's the beginning of the period of Charles Jacquot, it's a great period for the mix of black and white. And Cartier was very well known for black and white jewelry. And meaning, you know, onyx spots or onyx patterns on a background of paved diamonds.
Going into the Art Deco period.
20 years before.
20 years before.
And many patterns have been tried, you know, geometric, organic, and even those patterns evoking the panther. So it's present in the back of a watch, which is a pendant, but also on a wristwatch, a round wristwatch with a square dial, and all the case of a wristwatch is ornated with his black spots on the diamond background. What is not done yet is the exact stylization we will know in the future of those black spots. They are more organic at the time of Charles Jacquot. Then they will be, like in the shape of pentagons in the future. But the real portrait, let's put it that way, of a panther will come only in 1935, as in volume, I mean, as a ring. And recalling, the jewelry from the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, you know, heads of panther with a stone on in between two heads and things like that. So, and in fact, it's very interesting because many panther jewelry of the 80s will be linked to that original design of the 1930s.
So who decided for that original design in 1935?
This 1935 is definitely Jeanne Toussaint who gave her agreement to an original design.
So she went back through the archives and may have seen the Jacquot spots?
Probably no, because that was in yellow gold and not in platinum and diamonds. But before that, let's not forget that the first decision to represent a panther was Louis Cartier's decision, because you can see a gift in 1917 from Louis Cartier to Jeanne Toussaint. Jeanne Toussaint is not within the Cartier premises yet. She will be hired 2 years later. And it's a necessaire showing a panther in between two cypresses, like, you know, the representation of animals in the Ottoman tradition. And the panther is already in platinum with diamonds and with onyx spots. So this is interesting. And this definitely a reference to her nickname of La Panthère, you know. And it's the first representation in two dimensions this time of the panther and its decision of Louis Cartier. And that's how the representation of La Panthère will be definitely attached to her, you know. And then 2 years later, there will be another necessaire showing that. And always in two dimensions.
And he always called her My Little Panther.
We don't know that.
You don't
He
know
never
that.
Wrote La Panther. He never wrote about her as La Panthère.
Okay, so that might have been something private.
In between them, something more private.
And she visited Africa quite a lot, didn't she?
A lot, I don't know, but for sure she visited Africa in 1913. She went on a safari in Kenya together with Pierre de Quinsonnas. And we have in our archive some pictures of that trip, very, very interesting pictures, black and white pictures. A very elegant Jeanne Toussaint at the entrance of a tent, you know, and very interesting. And of course, that's when she saw her first panthers alive.
And that's probably then why she wanted to make them three-dimensional and to include that sense of movement.
I think movement is not exactly linked to the representation of a panther. I think, coming back to that notion of elegance, I think she was very much aware of what was de trop, or too much. And I think she thought that when the body is constrained by what you wear, it's not elegant. Elegance is the freedom of movement you have, and the things that you don't try too hard. You know what I mean? It's something that should be, everything you wear, everything you do, should be perceived as natural. So it has a very important consequences for the objects we create. The pieces of jewelry shouldn't be a constraint to your movements. Mm-hmm. So that's why flexibility and movement are key in the conception of our jewelry. And that's how you mentioned Cecil Beaton, for instance. Cecil Beaton mentions that Jeanne Toussaint is probably at the origin of the incredibly flexible jewelry and mobile jewelry we know today, because she had that in mind, that notion of elegance linked to the total freedom of a body, whatever the object you wear and you decide to wear. And this is very, very important. And when you move with such a bracelet, you can exaggerate your movement thanks to the movement of a piece of jewelry. So I have the impression that she even invented movements, gracious movements that could go with her creations, you know. And the volume, because volume was very important to Jeanne Toussaint, to the eyes of Jeanne Toussaint, because it was also an idea of more freedom to express yourself. If you have jewelry with volume, you in a way you occupy more space. You know, it's figurative, but it's also very, very true in terms of place of women within society. And she was calling that relief. Not volume, relief. And she wrote about that, you know, her love for that kind of jewelry. So it's also because of that increased volume of a jewelry she liked that probably articulation and flexible jewelry was even more important to her, I think, because it couldn't be something solid, something just a big volume on your wrist or on your neck. No, it had to be gracious and it had to be in total movement.
Having said that, the ones that she created for the Duchess of Windsor did have a large volume, mainly in large precious stones. How important was it that the Duchess of Windsor took up this style?
I think probably the Duchess of Windsor recognized herself in the representation of a panther. You know, the first link with the panther, the Duchess and Cartier takes place in 1948. When the Duke offers, an emerald, you know, it's a cabochon, an enormous cabochon, I have to say.
So this is over 100 carats.
Yes, it's really important. And Jeanne Toussaint has the idea to ask the designers to propose a solid gold panther to carry that cabochon of emerald. And of course, the Windsor says yes immediately. It's very quick. The development of that special order is very quick. It's given to the Duchess the very same year when it's ordered. And in 1949, a year later, another brooch is proposed, but for the stock, not a special order. It's around a very important, a very costly cabochon sapphire this time. And the panther is in platinum, the eyes are in yellow diamonds, and the panther is on top of it. So it's not gold, it's much more precious because it's platinum and diamond. So it's quite daring on the side of Cartier to invest so much in such a revolutionary design, because a 3D panther as a brooch has never been done before, as a brooch in such precious in such precious materials. So this is really, really daring. You know, I think it's a British magazine that was, an atomic bomb in the windows of a Cartier at the time because of that panther. And it was immediately bought by the Duchess. And what we discovered quite recently in our archives, we don't have the exact dates of the development of that brooch, but most probably that brooch was an idea of Jeanne Toussaint for herself before it was proposed for the stock. Most probably, the original design was for a representation of herself. And then it was proposed to the stock. I don't know why. Probably she thought she had not the money to buy it herself. I don't know. And then it was proposed for the stock. It will explain also why the decision was taken to develop it. Because if it was a special order for Jeanne, then you can imagine that it was easy to involve so platinum and diamonds for mm-hmm. that. But it's very, very interesting. So there's a direct link between Jeanne Toussaint, her own autoportrait, we could say, and the fact that the Duchess recognized herself in the representation of the panther.
So you
also
think they both shared some sort of feeling that they'd had very, very difficult times and
yes,
triumphed through them.
With very different journeys in their life, but with similar journeys in a way. Mm-hmm. Because when you think about the history of a Duchess before she married Edward VIII, I think you have similarities. She was a very independent lady before she married him. And then, you know, she always had, you know, let's say a specific personality to express, you know, and she had that freedom, and she brought her freedom that she enjoyed in a previous life in her new life she had as a Duchess. And that's very interesting because it's very similar to the journey of Jeanne herself, you know, with her previous life before meeting Louis Cartier and her second life after she met him and she was a creator at Cartier.
And both with this intense sensitivity to how they appeared and their sense
yes,
of style.
Definitely. And how they could express themselves through their appearance in a way.
And so everybody followed the Duchess in fashion terms, mm. and Daisy Fellows and
Mona Bismarck or
Barbara Hutton.
And it
became the thing.
Yes.
The thing.
There was a kind of rage around the representation of panthers. And also, you know, the anecdote, because Barbara Hutton wanted to be different, you know, since the panther was becoming so popular about those very important Café Society ladies, she wanted tigers. And once the Duchess of Windsor saw the tigers in the hands, or in the hands, on the body of Barbara Hutton, she wanted also a tiger, you know, and we produced, you know, the famous lunette, you know, for the Duchess of Windsor in the shape of a tiger. So there was a kind of competition, you know, among all those women. It's very interesting a bit later to see how Maria Felix, the Mexican actress, once she started to live in Paris, how she understood that and how she adopted the panther representation of Cartier herself as an independent woman herself, a different journey also with the same consequences in terms of behavior, and how first she bought panthers from Cartier from the stock, then she wanted her own panthers as special orders, and how then she evolved to other animals than panthers to be even more daring, you know, within the society of the time.
So you think in a way these women were embodied in the panther? It was their spiritual signal, as a way, in a way.
I think we have difficulties to imagine now the newness of the freedom that those ladies could enjoy at the time. Of course, they were privileged women because all of them were very wealthy and they had a social status that was very, very important, but they paved the way for all the other women in the world, you know, and they showed through the freedom they acquired how women in their behavior could acquire in a very similar manner their own freedom. So I think they opened the doors to many other women to express themselves in their own way.
Do you think this is the greatest legacy of Jean Toussaint at Cartier, though? The panther, was that her greatest legacy?
You know, she was mad about the panther because she was annoyed by the success of the panther. She wrote once that everybody wants the panther, the panther, the panther. While we have beautiful birds, we have snakes, we have crocodiles, we have lizards, we have turtles, we have beautiful creatures, and all what the women want is the panther, the panther, the panther. And probably, I think she was annoyed by the fact that she could recognize herself strongly in the panther, and everybody within Cartier could recognize that the panther was very much associated to her because of her own story. And she was modest, you know, and especially towards Cartier. You know, for instance, in the way she was signing the drawings to authorize them to be executed, she didn't sign by her own name, never. She never signed Jean Toussaint. It was à exécuter, to be made. And it was reduced to AX. So never, you will never find a drawing at Cartier with the signature of Jean Toussaint. It shows that she was considering herself like a tool, you know, mm-hmm. within the Cartier house, and not the boss, you know. And it's very, very interesting to, I think, that because it reveals, you know, the Cartier culture. At Cartier, we are all at the service of the Cartier house, you know, and only the family was visible at the time when the family was there. But what counted was the Cartier signature mm-hmm. only, and not the Jean Toussaint signature. And she knew that, and she put that in practice, you know, and it was very, very, very strongly stated in the way she was behaving in the name of Cartier.
Would it be possible for someone like Jean Toussaint to have that sort of career now? Would a brand recognize a unique sense of style and be able to nurture it? I can't see it happening now. Can you see it happening?
I think what she did and her talent and what she achieved is extraordinary given the context. I think there's a very specific context all along the 20th century. And especially for the status of women in general. I think in that field today, the possibilities are immense, I think. You don't see, you know, something forbidden to women, at least in terms of behavior, I mean. And I think it's thanks, by the way, to ladies like Jean Toussaint or Coco Chanel in the world of fashion, and many others. We can mention Elsa Schiaparelli and many others, and also in the fields of jewelry, by the way. And so the circumstances were very, very different. So today, I think, yes, definitely for women, there are careers, and there are careers today. Many, many women work within...
But nobody would be taken on just because they had a good sense of style. They would have to be a designer. They would have to be a maker. They would have to be
I think what you mentioned here is a great confusion. I think that is linked to probably the world of fashion, where you had or you have the definition of artistic dictators. You know, and the words are not mine; they have been pronounced by other people. But I think it's so true. In fact, within a house of jewelry, and specifically at Cartier, there is the conviction that the artistic dimension of our pieces, which is at the heart of a mission of Cartier, you know, it's the vision of Louis Cartier to add an artistic dimension to jewelry and to cultivate that artistic dimension. But with the idea that so many talents are involved in the definition of its artistic dimension, but it's not one person that can have that title. And effectively, you mentioned it. What is important at Cartier is the style of Cartier. And with in a very dynamic vision, by the way, because the style of Cartier is not, you know, frozen in a period, not frozen in an expression. But the notion of style as opposed to, someone would be in charge of on the artistic dimension is key to explain the Cartier culture, I think.
Do you think she'd be proud women are still wearing the panther, or do you think she'd still be a little annoyed?
I think she would be surprised. I think she would be surprised. She was surprised already at her time. And I think she would be surprised because, both Louis Cartier and Jeanne Toussaint, I think, had enormous intuitions. They could, you know, perceive what was going on. They were very sensitive to everything that was happening, and they were very much into the psychology of society. But they were not intellectuals. They were not, you know, creating theories or writing about, you know, those theories, you know, and they were not into that. And it was really about creators, you know, what creators are. And they are not necessarily putting in a book, you know, recipes or things like that. And I think also it was, I think, at least on the side of Louis Cartier, on purpose. Because I think their fear, if they had to write a kind of code of conduct of Cartier, the danger would have been bigger than the positive side of that, because the main danger for both of them was the absence of evolution and the absence of vision for the future.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Do you think it's sad they never married?
This is a good question. This is because that would be a total personal perception.
It would have been a nice romantic end to it.
Yes. Well, you don't rewrite history.
No.
I don't know. I hope both of them, in their own way, were happy at the end. They had different lives. They explored different paths. You know, the last time they saw each other was in the southwest of France, before Louis Cartier went to Spain and then to the US, and before Jeanne Toussaint got back to New York. I think they spent a lot of time there together, definitely. And their discussions must have been very interesting, but it's pure fiction. You know, we don't know what the exchange at the time.
The romance lives on in the jewels.
Yes.
Oh, Pia, thank you so much for sharing that story. It's fascinating and giving us a glimpse into her life. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Carol. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening. For this and other episodes of If Jewels Could Talk, please go to our website, carolwalton.com/podcasts. If you've enjoyed it, please share it any way you can, and we love to have a rating and a comment, so thank you. We have a new YouTube channel, so you can take a look at the back catalogue there and see some other videos and recordings. And we love to have questions. I'm on @CarolWalton on Instagram, so follow me there. And join me again in 2 weeks for the next Jewel Nugget. I'll be in LA with the coolest of the cool girl jewelers. Join me then, and thank you for listening. Bye-bye. If Jewels Could Talk with Carol Walton is produced by Natasha Cowan, music and editing by Tim Thornton, graphics by Scott Bentley, illustration by Geordie Labanda. You can find our sponsors at FuliGemstones.com and me at carolwalton.com.